Today's episode is brought to you in part by Zola. Advertisers like Zola keep the lights on at and a steady stream of trashy old school paperbacks hauled home from used booksellers to Blotter Presents HQ, so please support my sponsors. There is a promo code headed your way in the episode, so please keep an ear out for that, and thank you for listening. And now it's time for the episode.
Kiana Jackson, Harbor Boulevard and McFadden Avenue, 3:09 p.m., October 6th, 2013.
He's there.
Josephine Vargas, 1st Street and Tustin Avenue, 7:10 p.m., October 24th.
He's there.
Martha Anaya, 1st Street and Grand Avenue, 6:26 p.m., November 12th.
Martha, he's there.
Dirty John's Christopher Gofford returns to the LA Times / Wondery Joint Project beat with Detective Trap, about a lady cop in Anaheim who cracks a tough case. But as a podcast, is Detective Trap actually a really good long-form article? Later, we'll get into Rachel Monroe's Savage Appetites, the ethics and gendering of true crime fandom, and what the internet hath wrought. Grab a pair of very tiny scale model earbuds. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 124. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast analyzing which true crime is worth your time. Before I welcome today's guest, a couple of pod business notes. First of all, we have an episode next week. Then after that, we're off for Christmas. And then it's best of 2019 the week after that. Huzzah! The other piece of pod business is that my neighbors at Blotter Presents HQ minus one house number have decided that today is the day to begin a large-scale construction project, including official permits, which means that they can be as noisy as they want right now, and that's exactly what they're doing. So, listeners, please forgive me if you hear the sound of literally a set of stairs being crowbarred off the wall next door. Not a whole lot I can do about it, and unfortunately, it's not a crime that I can report. We'll all get through this together with, I'm very pleased to say, my great good friend Kevin Smokler, who has returned to the podcast. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me back.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad you're here, not least because I feel like I've been talking for about 20 minutes. So let's get into our most wanted section.
Indeed.
We are talking up top about Detective Trap, which dropped beginning last month. It is a podcast from the Los Angeles Times and Wondery, as I mentioned. Here's the case file from the Apple Podcasts landing page. Anaheim investigator Julissa Trap is not like other detectives. She's the only woman on the homicide squad and a skilled chameleon. Undercover cop in Vice stings, crime scene commander, patient confidant of killers. A master interrogator, she invokes her personal experience and deepest griefs as a tool to elicit confessions. When a young woman's body is found at a trash sorting plant, Trap learns the murder may be linked to the disappearance of three other women in nearby Santa Ana. Trap embarks on a dark journey that brings her face to face with a man who takes, quote, a little piece of her soul. The series is about a singular detective on a relentless, sometimes lonely quest for answers. Not cliches, though. Those are right here. Sorry. From the Los Angeles Times and Wondery, Detective Trap is a new story from Christopher Gofford, the writer and host of Dirty John, end quote, begin proper editorializing. As of this recording, I believe four of the episodes have dropped and probably the fifth will have come out. The fifth and final episode in the series will have come out probably by the time you listeners are hearing this. Kevin, how far did you get into this series? Have you listened to them all?
I did, yes. I was on a plane on my way home when I saw the fourth dropped, and so I downloaded it about 17 seconds before I was called into boarding.
Uh-huh.
And it was my entertainment, to use that word generously, during the first hour of my flight home.
Okay. Well, this is what you would expect from Wondery, which I feel like we are I am like carrying Wondery's lunch to school the last month and a half. We're definitely doing a lot of Wondery pods around here, and they're never badly made. But in our rundown doc, you had an incisive and also hilarious comment about what the show seems to be suffering from. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. And I'm so glad you think so, because I'm always worried when we put together these rundown docs that I'm going to make a bunch of kindergarten level jokes, and somehow they're just going to sort of seep into the firmament of the outline we're putting together.
I mean, first of all, who are you talking to? It's second of all, I think this was absolutely right on for what might be happening here and may have been happening with Dirty John, but please continue.
Yeah. So I should start by saying I ordinarily only pay passing attention to who produces podcasts, which I should be better about, because I have friends in this business, and I guest on a couple of different podcasts, and I've produced some of my own, but generally I have a vague sense of what one network does over the other and how one approaches the medium, and that's as much attention as I pay to it.
Sure.
And when I heard from the LA Times and Wondery at the beginning of Detective Trap, I had a passing thought of, well, I don't think I've heard a podcast from the LA Times, because I had forgotten Dirty John was from the LA Times. And then about 7.5 minutes in, I said, oh God, this is what happens when a newspaper is sort of wading in backwards to the ocean of podcasting and is looking back at the beach and thinking it can stay there and not get wet. I think the phrase I described it as is this is old media I made a poopy syndrome, which is an old media outlet doing essentially what it does when it produces content for its old media outlets in a new medium and thinking it doesn't have to change a thing. Feels like someone read an LA Times article into a microphone, and because you can get it in Stitcher or Downcast or Breaker or whatever, they're calling it a podcast.
Yeah,
it does not take advantage of the medium at all.
And there are some podcasts like this was something that Eve Beatty and I talked about vis-a-vis Wondery's American Elections Wicked Game podcast, which I'm still listening to. But it is definitely like they gave this guy who is like he's a good writer, and he gives you a good overview and a good sense of what was going on in, for example, 1824. Like, what political parties were there? Why were they like that? Da da da. But then he does reenactments.
Why Wakes is spelled WH.
Yeah. Yeah. But he also does all the reenactments and puts like echoey effects on sometimes. And also his name is Lindsey Graham, which is like, it's just fucking disconcerting because it's not that one. But the Washington Post had a sort of similar thing. Like, this one is all the elections leading up to the 2020 presidential election. That one was all the presidents, fun facts you didn't know leading up to the 2016 election.
Yeah.
And selection of president number 45.
And that particular podcast chose the narrator / host perfectly. I thought there is a tentative exploratory quality to Lillian Cunningham's voice, which is just right for taking on material that has been combed over and picked to death.
I liked her as a host. I think she did get a lot of clip for vocal fry, which is like, nobody uses that term correctly anymore.
No.
It's basically
no.
Like, she sounds like a little girl and I don't like it. Like, I thought she was great, but there was
nobody uses it without a giant spoonful of misogyny either. So.
Well, yeah, there's no one's going to complain about your vocal fry. I mean, or mine. Thank God. Here's my point. That Washington Post series was the perfect old media did a poopy, because the old media was perfectly. This was basically them reading an ongoing WAPO series to you with the occasional live interview, which, P.S., the sound often was bad. Mm-hmm. Like, it was not always great. But that, like, what you're saying is not necessarily a bad thing. But in this particular case, and especially, I tore through Dirty John, the podcast. Then I read the LA Times series, and that was even better. And then, you know, we all survived the Bravo adaptation, which was like, fine, but do we need this, or can you just cast it and then we'll be content to, like, oh yes, he's perfect for that role. And then you see 5 minutes of it and then you don't, like, you're done. In this case, like, it was much more obvious that this was being read. I don't think it necessarily added anything to have it be heard instead of read. I don't think it added anything. And on occasion, your point that sometimes things aren't changed, like, you have to, and I've discovered this sort of as I've transitioned away from mostly straight, like, blog and, you know, text reviewing into this medium, it's different. And things that you can get away with on the page that are overwritten, like, you hear yourself say them and it's like, while you were reading that, you should have asked for a reset and rewritten it.
Yeah.
So that it wasn't so bad.
Yeah. I mean, in text, to say something that we both and probably all the listeners know already, like, you can sort of create your own momentum with the reader. You can write something in such a way where the reader gets swept up. And even if you're overwriting it, the momentum of what you've done carries them past it, so they won't dwell on your ridiculous turns of phrases and similes. You can't do that with audio. The person is only gonna first of all, they decide how fast they listen, not you. And there's nothing you can do to make them listen faster or slower. And there's a quality of intimacy, because, you know, a podcast is in your ear and you can't hear the person who's speaking to it, where a bad turn of phrase or something that feels recited or transcribed rather than spoken, its artificiality is sort of really naked and obvious. And I think that happens quite a bit here. I know Christopher Gofford is coming off of Dirty John, which was a big hit, and he is coming off another story, another investigative piece that he had a large hand in reporting. I keep getting the sense that he's the wrong person for this hosting job, even if he was the right person to report it in the first place.
Or that somebody over there needs to kind of not think so textually about the way an audio property is structured. And here's what I mean. I actually, like, I have listened to 3 episodes. There's only 2 more. Mm-hmm. I'll probably finish it out. But there are things, and we'll talk about this a little more in the cold case section, because I think that property is a little bit better at being able to aurally put a pin in the ostensible topic and then step to one side and be like, and while I'm here, here's this other case, and here's something about this online community, and talk for quite some time about something that's tangentially related. This seemed like it was bringing up some excellent points and surfacing some problems with law enforcement and the missing white girl issue, for instance, regarding the view that sex workers and other marginal safety citizens are not as worthy of a full court press investigation when they go missing as others. But then it moves away from those things and comes back to Trapp's personal story, or it steps away from the investigation and is talking about her fertility journey, which I just, it did not work structurally for me. And it's also not why we're here. And I feel like no. This one's ear for stepping out of the plot, like crick, and letting it wash by to talk about something else for a while. Dirty John was way better at that than this, because, and also there's some overwriting that I don't remember from the last one, but here's an interview with one victim's mother who was really trying to get the Santa Ana police, who have a single missing persons person who is a civilian, P.S., getting these people to care about what's going on with her daughter and where she is. And so here's clip two.
Every time they had a meeting with me and her, it was always the same story. Oh, every cop has their flyer, don't worry. I told him if I was a wealthy woman, you'd be looking for her. I go, but since we don't have money, you don't care. That's it.
That's a great piece of tape, as Rebecca Lavoie would say.
Yeah.
And I am actually, I should say that I am not sure what the answer is structurally, whether it's to plant feet and get into that and talk about why Santa Ana has civilians working missing persons and how that works with Santa Ana PD and how this information was shared with Anaheim and all of that, or if the answer is to just keep moving. But something about this particular story, it felt like the transitions between, or it was just sort of like bopping from idea to idea, and then the segues were kind of like, meanwhile, back in the case, like, it just didn't quite work. And before I ask you to respond to that, I'm going to play a regrettable piece of prose in clip three.
When Julissa Trapp drives through her hometown of Anaheim, it feels to her like one big crime scene. Every street leads to the site of a remembered stabbing or shooting or chase, to close calls and hard lessons, to dead-eyed killers and inconsolable mothers.
Oh, man.
It's a mental map of what the jaded call Anna crime.
Okay, dead-eyed killers is a trope, as Bill James noted, that needs to be retired forever.
Yeah.
Is A.
Yeah.
B, even if people actually do call it Anna crime, that doesn't mean you should, and you should have cut that. Because that is definitely something that if you're reading it in print, like, I'm not going to get out a pen and write no in the margin. I might. Probably not. But when you're hearing it, like, it just comes in so much more slowly, and that set of synapses that I was like, the jaded call Anna crime. And this was preceded by, like, a full 12 seconds of moody clarinets after an ad that I'm like, guys, everyone's roll busy. It's peak podcast. Get to it.
Yeah. I love that moody clarinets. I'm gonna write that one down right now.
know, and in the margin, I'm going to put, no, because I mean, exactly. Are they moody? Do you need that descriptor, Sarah? No, you don't. So do you have any thoughts on that, like, structural flow I've been talking about?
Yeah, I want to give my thoughts, which are fairly brief, and then I want to turn it back around and ask you a question, which is, the flow to me, like we've said already, the flow to me seems like it's the kind of thing that works in a 5,000 word feature article, or maybe broken into two parts, and nobody thought beyond that how it broke down into six podcast episodes.
I think that's part of it.
It reads like an unholy grafting of a previous draft of something onto this different format, and nobody nobody thought what the creature would look like when we yeah. when we, you know, sewed the mouse on the back of the raccoon.
Right. Is that a nose on your neck?
Yeah. So it does have that problem. The Anna Crime thing is the Anna Crime thing should have been edited out back when this was a newspaper article, because yeah. That's something that everybody who lives in Anaheim has heard 15 times before. Mm. And the LA Times is Anaheim is part of the circulation area of the LA Times. So that's like telling a knock knock joke and expecting someone to beam at your originality.
Yeah.
I think that to me feels like a smaller version of a larger problem, which is this. I can't tell if I'm just being unfair to a giant metro to a giant city newspaper as sort of a whipping post for old media. But this feels there's a vague yet permeating sense of entitlement to this to me, which is that the LA Times and its staff writer Chris Gofford here wants credit for doing something that journalistically is special in the most basic way, but beyond that, like, really isn't. And the question I want to ask you is, do we feel this way because when it comes to true crime, you and I are neck deep in this stuff?
Right.
Or is it really kind of lazy and a little entitled for the producers and host of this podcast to think that the people listening to it have never need a basic education in missing white woman syndrome?
I think it's both. I will also say that I think a big part of the problem is that I'm not sure what the podcast actually is and how it has been pegged. Like, I mean, let me back up. I love the show Bosch, and I'm always recommending it, even though it's like a high B plus. Like,
yeah,
A minus. Like, it gets up to like a 91 or 92.
Yeah, it's no one's favorite show. Like, nobody. Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, it's never going to be my least favorite show. Like, even the worst episode of Bosch is still like an 86 because it isn't a competently done, occasionally over stylized, but extremely like waterproof procedural. It's nothing more than that. It's nothing less than that. And it does what it does, which is not reinventing the procedural wheel, extremely well and extremely consistently. And I don't think there is anything wrong with coming in and being like, from the host and author of Dirty John, here is this story. But for whatever reason, like, really the story is the case, but they're selling it as the story of the detective, and in podcast it's having an identity crisis. It does make
very
at
much
one
so.
Point good use of her sort of teenage rebellion as a way to talk about how she's informed in her interactions with certain kinds of victims, living and otherwise. But I wanted it to dig into that more, and it didn't. And that was another case where I thought the lead up to the revelation was too long, and then not enough time was spent with that information. I think that part of it is that, you know, I at least listen to this stuff as my part of my job. And so my standards are both higher and lower. I would also say that I suspect Gofford just like wrote this thing and was like, this is an amazing story. And she has a really snappy name, like Detective Trap. Two P's. Yeah. The extra P is for police. Like, I mean, sure. And then whoever at Wondery was like, all right, we can sell that, but we're going to do this kind of there's like this weird sort of like slightly dated feminism to it that just feels like, first of all, she's still the only homicide dick with no dick in 20 whatever, like 15 years into the 21st century. That's a little weird. Talk more about that, and they might. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it just felt like, well, Cagney and Lacey, like, I don't know. It's hard to articulate what about this, like, you know, one woman's journey into the heart of darkness just felt, that's where I was a little turned off, that it's like her, you know, the fertility journey, the struggles that she faced with like the tone. Actually, let me just play a clip.
I'm a little rough around the edges sometimes. I don't have time for feelings.
Once she let her frustration show at the scene of an 8-year-old shooting death, the male sergeant on duty kept saying, "I don't know," to her questions until she snapped, "What do you know?" A male lieutenant pulled her aside to chastise her. Had she done anything wrong? Had she broken any policy? No, they were just talking about that elusive and subjective thing, tone. It wasn't the last time. She learned some strategies.
If I add a, "I'm sorry, could you please," so with a little softer voice, that it gets the job done just as well. Do I think I should have to resort to that? Maybe not, but I really don't care. It's about getting the job done. If I have to add a curtsy at the end, I'll even do that.
I mean, in another universe, that's your whole podcast.
Right.
It's her being like, here's all the garbage that I've had to deal with that I dealt with so that I would, you know, be able to build a career and get respect. Like, literally every woman on earth or woman identified person on earth has a version of this story, including me and my colleagues who refer to Sarah Ask Voice, which is way up here. Like, it almost doesn't even make any sound because that's not my natural register.
Yeah.
But sometimes if you want people to give you a woman something, you have to sound a little more like a woman and less like a country singer. So that's, I mean, you do what you have to do. But
yeah,
I think that's your podcast.
Definitely. I mean, that's this podcast. That's an interest. Let's take it back to the root. That's an interesting story for the LA Times to do. I don't know for sure. I have serious doubts that there is only one or no female homicide investigators on the LAPD, which is a police force, is probably five times the size of Anaheim's police force.
Yeah.
Something about at issue there, not primarily, but definitely part of the question here is, how big is Anaheim's police force? How sexist or misogynist is their police department? What are the internal wrongs and factors that have kept that make Julissa Trapp, as talented as an investigator as she is, a singular entity, only
well,
one.
And what about the relationship to Los Angeles and the notoriously tangled jurisdictional presentation of that part of the country? Because you have LAPD and you have the sheriff's office and you have parks and you da-da-da-da-da, on and on. Like, this is true of a lot of places.
Host of Detective Trapp, Chris Gofford, has explored this territory before. I think he, if I'm not mistaken, my understanding is he made his bones at the LAPD as part of the investigative team that reported on and uncovered endemic corruption, city corruption and government corruption in the small town of Bell, California, which I believe is in LA County. And that reporting was the basis of the woebegotten second season of True Detective.
So he was an LAPD investigator or LA Times?
He was an LA Times investigative journalist, and
focused on LAPD. Gotcha.
Yeah, he was part of the Times investigative reporting team that broke the story of the stink in City Hall in Bell, California, wide open.
I don't think I remembered that was a true story, that it was a true detective. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I mean, even though the episode feels like, you know, feels like a pages from the script of Chinatown left on the floor of the screenwriter's, you know, back deck.
I was going to say bathroom. Sure.
Yeah, that's better actually. I think there's, yeah, this podcast doesn't know what it is, because you and I just having this few minutes of conversation and listening to it once through have already uncovered that maybe it's a story about the one woman investigator, a homicide investigator in this police department. Maybe that story takes in why she's the only woman. Maybe it's a 60-minute frontline documentary on female homicide investigators all over the country. As you know, David Simon wrote in his book, Homicide, Basis of Television Series, way back in, I think that was 1991 or two, rarely do people come to homicide investigation as a career in law enforcement because they're simply interested in reaching the top of the mountain and it's the most prestigious job in policing. They come to it because investigating murders is very personal, and something and how they investigate reveals something about why they chose this as their law enforcement career in the first place. In that way, it's a little bit like jazz, where, you know, your interpretation says something about you, as opposed to, like, you know, corporate America, where, you know, homicide investigation is the C-suite. There's a lot that could have been done with that, and I'm not going to criticize Detective Trap for what it isn't. I'm just going to say the choice it made feels like it feels like they have given up after they wrote the original pieces of journalism about it.
Yeah, or like they didn't make a choice, which is itself a choice. But I think there's like actually three legit podcasts in here that are like, are they extremely ambitious? No. Do we need more ambitious podcasts? Not really. Tell me a good story, be in and out of it in 4 40-minute segments. Fine. Done. Like, one of the things I definitely can thumbs up about this is that they're like, it's 5 parts. We're out.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's just a Wondery thing. They like 5 for whatever reason. But I mean, in the second episode, she's talking about, like, she was a teenager and she's, you know, she's a police explorer, but like her grades are really crappy. She gets involved with this older guy. Her parents are like, quit sneaking out or leave. And she's like, fuck you, and leaves. And then she kind of has to disentangle herself from this older guy. And that gives her a lot of insight into how young women are preyed upon and how it might seem like young women are, quote, allowing things to happen, when in fact that's not really the case. Here's our final clip from this section.
Oh, it definitely helps me relate with some of the victims that I ran into later, and understanding how impressionable and how vulnerable you are and how easy it is for someone to take advantage of that. And then once you're in the situation, how difficult it is to get out, especially when you don't have resources. I had resources and I was ultimately able to escape that relationship. But there's a lot of different reasons why women stay.
I mean, there's another whole podcast right there. Or like how not only sex work has changed in the last 10 years, but like why? How much of it, like, there's a little piece of it in there where they're talking about, like, you first go undercover in a, like, honey trap situation, and you're, like, with the tank top and the heels, and then you realize that most of the people working this strip are in, like, a ratty flannel and flip-flops, because this is the economy you're dealing with. Like, I want a whole podcast about this strip, the beach. I would love an investigative frontline series about, I mean, I wouldn't love it. It would be miserable and I would be sad listening to it. But the evolution of sex work in the internet age and during the opioid crisis, like, there is a lot of material here. And I think the LA Times or whoever was sort of responsible for the packaging of this in whatever format was like, the hook is Lady Detective. And yes and no, like there are better, like there's a bunch of stories. It's not just Lady Detective. Like we contain multitudes. Hi. So
yeah,
it's just frustrating because it should be better than it is, I think, is my bottom line.
Yeah. And I don't want to make too much of this because I think what you said is dead on. And I think they probably said Lady Detective and here's an LA Times series that, you know, has a beginning, middle and end. Let's go.
Yeah.
But I also
Gofford knows who signs his checks. Like, I'm not really holding him responsible for any of this. Like, he did the work.
Right. But I also think there's, and like I said, I don't want to make too much of this because it's become sort of an obvious thing to say. But we might want to take just a second to look at this in the context of what hath Serial wrought. And
yeah.
And is this yet another example of a true crime podcast where the host slash producers think it's okay to simply walk you through the steps of an investigation and feel like they've done something revelatory because, hey, Serial did that 5 years ago. And look at what a massive game changer that was. I think this mistake gets made over and over again when is successful and game changing. And in the case of Serial, what has happened is there's Detective Trap. If that's what happened here, is not the first example of a podcast to miss the point of why Serial was as successful as it was, which is, yes, it was essentially about journalism and investigation and walking you through reinvestigating a crime from 20 years ago. But it was also about the nature of truth and doubt, which is because
extremely personal in the way that you were just talking about with homicide investigators who do that as their job, that it was, it became the same thing. But yes, you're absolutely right. Sorry to interrupt.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, Sarah Koenig, the series begins and ends with Sarah Koenig having a reporter-reportee relationship with Anand Saeed, the accused, and whether or not she is being told the truth, which is a question that is at the heart of every journalistic endeavor. So Serial is about a crime and is about re-reporting and reinvestigating a crime, but it becomes a way to not only ask fundamental questions about journalism, but about the act of producing true crime media and popular culture, which is that you have to weave something into a coherent narrative, even if the nature of true crime is there is no coherent narrative, because something happened and only the people involved know actually what happened. So it contained in the DNA of it is that some part of the story will always be missing.
Right. And that's part of the, you know, that's always my theory. That's part of the appeal. Trying to know the unknowable is what drives or control the uncontrollable or both.
Yeah. And I think there's a bit, I'm not saying this is exactly what happened, but there is a plausible argument here that that Detective Trap is merely trying to sort of do Serial without, and leaving out consciously or unconsciously what made Serial special at all.
Or just unwilling to take a couple of things off. Like you have to decide, unfortunately, what is the heart of your story? And the fact is it may be different in text from what it is audio. Like
indeed.
Is working and sort of singing might be different. But yeah, this just seems, I mean, we're sounding extremely negative, but it is like, it is very listenable with a couple of exceptions as noted. And her story is interesting. I just think that they needed to have the courage of their convictions in terms of either we are going to make this about her as a her, which is and the unusualness of that and the challenges of that, or this is going to be about the case and we're just going to do a straightforward procedural, which again See my previous comments on Bosch. There's nothing wrong with that. The world has room for them. But instead, it was like, this podcast, we're going to try to appeal to a bunch of different like sectors, I guess, within the genre. And then kind of nothing is being fully explored. I felt like, again, it just comes down to, I wanted this to be better than it is.
Yeah.
I am going to keep listening to it. And again, it's not, we've listened to far worse on the show.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I think, the point you made about Bosch, which to me is very salient, is Bosch knows what it is. It also knows its ambitions are not particularly high, but it's very clear right. on what those ambitions are and what it results in.
Well, and it's also an adaptation of text. So
yeah.
like this is possible to do. You just have to like understand what the differences are to the medium anyway.
Yeah, this seems to be a bad sort of grease lightning, you know, bumper from here, carburetor from there, Frankenstein of a couple of different things that could have worked, but together don't add up to something that does.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. That said, I'm going to finish it because I'm interested to see, like, now that it's interrogation time, where I am in the podcast, I think we're going to see some fireworks. So I hope I'm right. And even if I'm wrong, it's only another couple hours of my life. So once again, that is called Detective Trap. Two P's. That is an LA Times Wondery co-production from the Dirty John guy. And that's wherever you download podcasts. Before we move on to our cold case section, a word from our sponsor, Zola. According to a recent Zola survey, 96% of couples think that planning their wedding was stressful, and 86% suffered stress-induced symptoms like insomnia, breakouts, and lower sex drive. Those percentages seem low to me. Dan and I had a pretty low-key, short-date wedding. It was in the backyard. I wasn't wearing Spanx, but there was still agita. About the weather, older relatives not understanding how an email RSVP is in the world. Does everyone understand that it's July and we actually sincerely want you to dress comfortably? Good news, y'all who are in the thick of this. Zola makes wedding planning easier and less stressful with wedding websites, registry, invites, and a guest list manager all in one place. Hallelujah.
Oh, thank the Lord.
Zola features free wedding website designs. You can create your site in minutes, complete with a custom URL. And features include a frequently asked questions page, which is great for mutely pointing people to when they ask awkward questions about plus ones, whether their kids are invited, and so on. There's an online RSVP page. Hopefully your older relatives will get the knack. Plus, guests can shop your registry right on that site. And Zola has the highest rated registry site of all time for a reason. You can register for gifts, experiences, and honeymoon funds. You can add gifts from other stores. You can sync existing registries. There's free shipping and returns and price matching. And you can even set up group gifting. And Zola also offers beautiful, affordable invites and paper. You can shop your entire paper suite at Zola, from save-the-date cards to invitations and thank you notes. They're all designed to match your wedding website, and you can customize those with your own photos and wording and whatnot. Plus, Zola helps you collect addresses and track online RSVPs with their guest list manager. That's free. Also free, they'll even address your envelopes. And for someone with physician's handwriting like mine, who had to make Dan do the entire thing, that would have been a huge help. That particular help can be on its way for you today. Just sign up at zola.com/blotter today. That's zola.com/blotter, BLOTTER. And use promo code PAPER30 to get 30% off your invites and paper order. That's zola.com/blotter and promo code PAPER30, PAPER30. Zola has helped 1 million couples get married, and they can help you too. Thank you so much, Zola. All right, now it's time for the cold case section. We are talking about a book today. It is a book that Patreon supporters had been voting for pretty strongly in the monthly bonus book review polls, but it never quite pulled it out. It's called Savage Appetites, and it is by Rachel Monroe. Here's the case file from the book's Amazon landing page. Buckle up. This is a little long, but I think it's important. In this illuminating exploration of women, violence, and obsession, Rachel Monroe interrogates the appeal of true crime through four narratives of fixation. In the 1940s, a frustrated heiress began creating dollhouse crime scenes depicting murders, suicides, and accidental deaths. Known as the mother of forensic science, she revolutionized the field of what was then called legal medicine. In the aftermath of the Manson family murders, a young woman moved into Sharon Tate's guest house and, over the next two decades, entwined herself with the Tate family. In the mid-90s, a landscape architect in Brooklyn fell in love with a convicted murderer, the supposed ringleader of the West Memphis Three, through an intense series of letters. After they married, she devoted her life to getting him freed from death row. And in 2015, a teenager deeply involved in the online fandom for the Columbine killers planned a mass shooting of her own. Monroe argues that each woman represents and identifies with a particular archetype that provides an entryway into true crime. Through these four cases, she traces the history of American crime through the growth of forensic science, the evolving role of victims, satanic panic, the rise of online detectives, and the long shadow of the Columbine shooting. In a combination of personal narrative, reportage, and a sociological examination of violence and media in the 20th and 21st centuries, Savage Appetites scrupulously explores empathy, justice, and the persistent appeal of violence. End quote. So, Kevin, I think that you had some doubts as to whether these, all of these investigations belonged together, or whether, maybe it was like too scrupulous an exploration in terms of trying to tie everything together. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I love a tight premise, and I love a book that applies a kind of journalistic rigor to something I've heard of before and ends up approaching it in a whole different way. And I think this book and Rachel Monroe succeed very admirably at that. The four examples she uses are all examples that I have read, heard, seen elsewhere. And that's not just because I love true crime pop culture. That's because I think they are well explored. And yet I never did feel like, oh, Jesus, again with the West Memphis Three. Oh, God, again with the Manson murders.
I didn't feel that way either, and that's really something, especially given something. How much time we've all forcibly been obliged to spend with the Manson murders this past year, thanks to the anniversary and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you again.
No, there's a rigor to her reporting and to her her initial premise that I think means each of these four examples are framed in a very different way, and she has done the footwork to make sure that what she is saying is not simply pointing to a shelf of secondary source material and saying, look what I did.
Right.
That said, the book, which by the way, as a reading experience, is wonderful. The book is super fast, and yet you don't feel like you're just doing aerosol can whippets when you're reading it. Like it actually
right. You read a physical copy because went audiobook, and it that experience, as we were saying before, like just that like neural inputting is a little different. Mm-hmm. The narrator has occasionally a flat Midwestern A that sneaks in Jenny Garth style. It is not Jenny Garth. I regret to inform you. Although, okay, you know what? Never mind. we'll come back to like fantasy casting 90210 stars as audiobook narrators some other time.
The spinoff podcast from The Blotter Presents.
The Zip Presents. There is a feeling of trust like she will sort of start with whoever she's talking about. Elisa Statman, I think the woman's name is, who basically like embedded herself in the Tate family like permanently.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know anything about her or about that. She'll start on like what Lori Eccles was up to when she first saw the documentary and the but then she'll sort of hit pause and step into this is what the internet looked like at that time, and this is how much more difficult it was before Reddit and before Facebook to sort of, you know, create a community around justice for these three men who were often thousands of miles away from us. Like, I watched their press conference and their release like live on the internet with my brother, and we were both weeping. Like, it really was a journey that like the internet went on with these men, but there's only so far that journey can go. So she spends some time unpacking that, and then she goes back into Lori's perspective on their story. But there's always that trust, which is, this is what I was alluding to earlier in the section on Detective Trap, that I wasn't always sure that we were going to, like, where are we going to come back in? Like, how are we going to get back there from here? And in the Monroe, I always was like, well, this is going to be like an hour of her talking about like Columbiner memes, which I still found extremely shocking and disturbing.
Yeah.
And then we come back into the main part of the story, and to throw a plate that high in the air and talk about a completely different but related issue, and then step over and be like, boop, like it, down it comes, and you're like, and here I am catching this plate. It's impressive. It's much harder to do than she makes it look as well.
Yeah. There's a real deftness and dexterity in the way this story is told. I have my problems with the way the story all comes together, because I don't quite think it does. But part of what makes this a good read, which is to my mind, the first and most difficult thing any piece of nonfiction needs to accomplish, is how seamlessly she seems to sort of iris in and iris out. And now
yes.
I'm talking about the time I spent with my principal subject, and now I'm contextualizing it, and now I'm racing us forward because this happened 20 years ago and it wasn't an unknown event, and we all know how this ends, but now I'm back, and there's a lot of pirouetting and soft shoeing here that she does without leaving a trace. And you don't get lost, and you manage to kind of hold on to all the parts of the story.
And then when she brings you back in, there's always a little like, just so you know, here's a mental bookmark for you. Because I listened to it on audiobook, hey Audible, thanks buddy, I was able to cut a couple of clips, and I'd like to play one now that is a great example of how she talks about issues that are definitely sort of front of mind for people who consume and comment on true crime, especially in the last year or 2 years, how we are prioritizing victims in their own stories, even if the crime meant their story ended. Which victims have we historically prioritized? How are victims and like criminal justice reform put at odds with each other in a like false comparison? This is all stuff that if you read and listen to et al. As much as we do, like you think about it already, but she manages to if you're just reading her book because you're like friends with her, I don't know, and you're like a florist, that she's like, okay, just in case you haven't been following along in this genre for the last couple of years, here's what's at stake. And I'm not, like, I have no doubt who that's for. It's for everyone. It's for people who follow this genre closely, and it's for people who were just like, huh, this looks interesting. It's for, you know, feminist studies scholars, whatever. Here's an example from, I believe, the chapter on Elisa Statman and the Tate family.
The underlying unarticulated assumption of the political talk was that victims and criminals were two distinct categories of people with diametrically opposed interests. Victims were righteous innocents whose violation needed to be honored and whose safety needed to be guaranteed. They were pitted against offenders, unrepentant, unredeemable figures who profited from a naively lenient system. The two sides were locked in a zero-sum game where any concessions made to criminal defendants were seen as a loss for victims, and where supporting victims became equated with being tough on crime. If the victims' rights movement had limited its appeal to actual victims of violent crime, it would never have grown to be as large or as powerful as it did. The movement's genius, the thing that made it enough of a political force that we now have a federal office for victims of crime, and that most states now have constitutional amendments enshrining victims' rights, was transforming who counted as a victim.
There's that Midwestern A.
Yes. Yeah.
Hey, girl, yeah. I see you. It goes on from here to talk about things we already know, again, that victims are disproportionately people of color and the incarcerated are disproportionately people of color, but that's not reflected in this rhetoric that came out of the 80s and was like, you know, they're coming for your white daughters, basically. Like, I don't, you know, not to be too reductive, but unfortunately...
Completely true.
But she has a way of, like, she doesn't use the term dog whistle, but it's one of the more cogent explanations that I've heard of it. And again, this is something that, these numbers are something that, as someone who reviews these properties, I sit with them all the time and I'm disgusted by them all the time. And I'm not necessarily looking for it to be re-explained to me. But I didn't care. I didn't mind. I wasn't fast forwarding through it. It was like, okay, like I already know this, but this is really well done. Good for her.
I find it as a writer, and I'm not gonna try and speak for you as a writer, but personally, I find it very difficult to do this kind of is everybody following along kind of moment in storytelling without it sounding condescending, without it sounding lead-footed, and instead having it sound like simple professional responsibility, which I think is what it is. It is just being generous and responsible towards the reader's experience to occasionally pop your head out of the narrative and say, is everybody still with me?
Well, and she says, I think that her job not that long ago was writing like garbage time explainers for Bloomberg or something like that. So she knows how to do this. I agree. As a writer, I was like, I know how hard that was to do. So
yeah,
good for you. I would also, I pulled a teeny little clip of her talking about, Damien Echols of the West Memphis Three's sort of initial presentation of himself to the world. This is, bar none, the best summation I've ever heard of the frustration of watching him just like being 18 years old in this very serious situation in clip 7.
Someone more cowardly or more strategic, might have made a play to seem chastened, or at least less interested in the occult. But Damon was thoroughly, disastrously himself.
I mean, if someone
shades of Amanda Knox,
write her another check, someone, to name your memoir that. Like, thoroughly, disastrously himself. The Damien Echols story. Like, that is... perfect, because still, I will watch like footage from that documentary or see a still photo of him when he was in the beginning of the process and just be like, son, stop. Like, stop. I gotta be me. Like, you don't gotta. It's gonna get your ass killed. So that was really a nice bit of business. And yeah. The chapter on Lindsay and James and the Columbiners and the way that she unpacks online personae and versus IRL, and also that for people younger than us, like, what's the difference between your online persona and your personality? Should we make that distinction? Is it useful legally? Is it useful psychologically? I thought it was excellent. This is a really good book. There are some bits that are slow. Like, I feel like the first chapter was on Lee, the crime scene nutshell lady.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe needed to be
its own book and just pulled out.
Yeah, the socialite who sort of spent her money successfully professionalizing crime scene investigation in this country and did so, you know, long before we could did so in part by creating these fantastic investigative tools, which were dioramas of crime scenes where law enforcement would use them as training devices to come in and try and solve the murder presented in these little tiny dioramas.
It just seemed to be from a different, because it was like first half of the 20th century and everything mm-hmm. else was, you know, the last 50 years.
Yeah.
It's not that it didn't go for that reason, but there was like, if you had asked me sort of halfway through that first section, what are you going to rate this on Goodreads? It would have come in at around a 3.5 out of 5. It just takes her a while to get going, and she didn't seem quite as the momentum wasn't there quite as well, and she didn't seem quite as sure of herself. I feel like maybe that was like an edit board suggestion that it's like, well, you got to put her in because, you know, they had that whole CSI subplot about like. And I could see her being like, oh, yay. And then she has to go and see the nutshells. Like, there's just something about a true crime author or podcaster being like, I'm in the place where this great tragedy, like, that does almost nothing, in my opinion. But okay. So if it were mine to redo, I would split that off into another book if she wanted to write it. But if she didn't, all right, here's what. You're following Detective Julissa Trapp around for a year.
Yeah.
Then you're writing a book on that, and then this whole podcast is going to reach its like correct outcome in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, it is very clear in the small moments of Savage Appetites that Rachel Monroe has the chops for this subject for telling a story of this scope in general. She has a fantastic small moment near the end of the Columbiners, which we should say was a group mostly on Tumblr that sort of turned the perpetuators of the Columbine mass murder into kind of cult celebrities and effectively wrote fan fiction about them.
Yeah, it was like how they used to talk about Twilight. But.
Yeah, and she has a moment where she said, where she talks about sort of the object of adoration of a teenage girl. And she says,
yes.
You know, for me, when I was growing up, it was Gavin Rosdale, the lead singer of Bush, who frankly, I didn't think was all that attractive. And B, I didn't like his band all that much. the idea being that the adoration of a teenage girl, as she framed it, and it's been framed this way before, but I think she did it very elegantly, is not, is not purely sexual, is not idealization, but it is in fact a way to be heard in a world that is not interested in listening to you. And she has this wonderful turn of phrase where she equates the kind of endless scroll of Tumblr with the endless exhale of the crush of a teenage girl in the throes of that crush. That's masterful.
She also has, and I wrote this down, that the teenage girl with a crush is also capable of crushing. And
yes.
The fear that this, both the condescension and the terror that this inspires in the rest of the world, like, you could write a PhD thesis, or at least one, I think,
yeah,
on that attitude towards fans of New Kids on the Block.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great book that came out in the 90s called Where the Girls Are, which is a kind of,
yes, that is
feminist,
fantastic,
fan history of American popular culture by Susan Douglas. And it talks about how part of what parents and authority figures have always perceived as the danger of popular culture in this country is that it is capable of sending teenage girls into hysterics.
Yeah, that it's going to set us off. And
and I think Rachel Monroe rightfully frames that there's a kind of power in that, perhaps a dangerous out of control power, but a power nonetheless. And it's not simply a spell cast over passive teenage girls.
Right. And how teenage girls take agency.
Yes.
In it. We have one more clip, which is actually about the experience of, which I think we all just take as, you know, second screen as second nature at this point. But like, it actually took a little bit of effort once upon a time to see a thing on HBO and be like, I need to find the other people who saw this. Here's our final clip.
Often it started in a similar manner. A person watched a documentary or saw a short news clip about a case, and the story left them with a kind of mental itchiness, let's call it. Even if there were an arrest and a verdict, they sensed that more was there, a story underlying the official narrative, one that was messier and more complicated and more true. Maybe they thought the stated motives didn't make sense, or that crucial evidence had been overlooked. Maybe they thought that innocent people had been convicted, or that guilty people had gone free. Maybe they didn't trust the cops to do a fair investigation, or thought the media had unfairly taken sides, or that the DA was corrupt. Maybe they just wanted to make up their own mind. And so they went online.
And so they went online. Like, that's my entire fucking career, basically, except it was my so-called life and not the West Memphis 3, but I did have the bumper sticker, like, you know, I had the bona fides. She really has a way of taking you through an issue that it's like, how did you even get your arms around this? And just is like, well, here's the section of it that I carved off that we can get our arms around, and here's a description of the section, and then we're going to go back to the main topic. So yeah, well done. Like, I think there are some, what's the word I want? Not self-conscious. I think the forced, I guess, a little bit with the framing of Crime Con. And
yeah,
I think she could have maybe taken a stronger position on, like, the thing she describes at the end of the book, where basically they're like, it's a room full of women in blindfolds, like, restrained.
Yeah.
With their arms over their heads. And it's like, I mean, I don't think it's necessary to model objectivity about that experience, which I think is, like, deeply fucked up and also has been monetized by a television network. But these are pretty minor quibbles. I would definitely recommend this book, 100%.
Yeah, I would too. The fact that the book probably reads better in micro than it does in macro is not a reason not to read it. I mean, it essentially, I think, at its best, is four really good magazine pieces about true crime.
Yes.
And the fact that in its ideal form, this book should be a collection of pieces of Rachel Monroe's true crime reporting, as opposed to this premise, which seems, and by the way, I would be fine if all of those pieces were told, had the lens of women and feminism and crime. I think that's a rich vein to explore for years and could be the basis of anybody's successful
for
reporting.
Sure. Savage Appetites 2, even Savager, I am there. Yeah. Hardcover on it.
Yeah, but I think that the premise that she sort of frames this in feels to me like something I could be wrong, and I'm probably wrong actually, but it feels to me like something that was imposed upon by a publisher because like Rachel Monroe wasn't a journalistic star yet, and therefore a collection of her reporting is not as attractive as a book that is in this that is kind of shoehorned into this premise that doesn't quite fit.
I agree, and I think that's probably where that first section came from, because parts of it are definitely I mean, they're well written and she feels invested, but again, that did feel, if I had to pick one section that it was like the editor made me do it, that's the one. So but despite that, it's a ripping yarn, as they say.
It is a ripping yarn. I'm not going to say I could have done it better than Rachel Monroe, because I don't think I could have, but I almost wonder what would have happened if the first chapter, instead of being this narrative from the you know, early part of the 20th century, was in fact about Crime Con and where Crime Con came from and how it and how we got here. I think it would almost work better as a pillar rather than you know, the awning.
I agree.
If for only that it takes four, or at least I would say two, of the most overexplored crimes of the last 50 years and manages to make that exploration sound fresh and different, to me that's reason enough to pick this book up.
Yes, absolutely. And worthy heir to David Gran and Pamela Koloff, in my personal long reads Rushmore. So yes, carve her face on that mountain. Once again, Rachel Monroe, Savage Appetites. Support your local booksellers, or if you click the link that will be in our show notes, it will take you to Amazon, and we might make a couple of pennies from that. We appreciate your support. Kevin Smokler, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for coming back today.
I appreciate you and the opportunity, Sarah Bunting.
So before you leave us...
In local news today, bees.
Please tell us where else listeners can find your work and what you've got coming up.
You can find my work, my books and talks and essays and such at kevinsmokler.com. That's S-M-O-K-L-E-R. I leave a lot of stuff on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Weegee, W-E-E-G-E-E. And I am currently finishing up a feature-length documentary about the comeback of vinyl records, which is called Vinyl Nation and will be out next year.
Can't wait. Thanks again for coming back.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Jeb Lund returns to talk about Truth Be Told and some terrible Netflix show about dark tourism. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and at Eves and My True Crime Review newsletter, Best Evidence, bestevidence.fyi. From now until the 15th of December, a full year of Best Evidence is just $52. That's only $1 a week. And you marrying kinds can support The Blotter Presents by visiting zola.com/blotter and using that code PAPER30 for 30% off invites and paper. All y'all can support the podcast by rating and 5-star reviewing it in your podcast app of choice. My guest has been Kevin Smokler. Like he said, he's on Twitter at Weegee. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.